This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon, and Rahul is off today. We're here with Reza Devani. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Pretty close. Reza Devani. Yep.
Reza. And Reza is a highly successful plaintiff trial lawyer from Baltimore, Maryland. And we're going to get into some of his cases and some of his great verdicts in a little bit. But Reza, can you start out by just kind of telling the listeners a little bit about you and your life and how you found your way into this crazy career choice of trying plaintiff's cases?
Yeah, sure thing. Well, thank you for having me. It's exciting to be here and to just share space with great lawyers and share ideas. I'm not a typical track in terms of how I ended up in this profession. I'm a longtime Marylander, lived here since I was about 5 years old. Dad was working for health and nutrition. I was very much in health and nutrition. There was a period of time where I thought I'm probably going to be like a personal trainer or something involved in health and nutrition because I grew up surrounded with that. I did at one point do freelance personal training. My schooling was just very generic business, marketing, nothing law related. Graduated and entered the workforce, did professional sales, did some banking. When poker got popular, when Chris Moneymaker won the World Series of Poker, I think in the early 2000s, I actually quit my job at a regional bank and became I'll call it a semi-professional poker player because it only lasted about a year. A lot of that works into the work I do now, but I left professional poker and did a bunch of other mixed stuff and eventually decided I need something a little bit more stable long-term, and law sounded like a good idea. So I flipped the coin, took the LSAT, did all right, and ended up in law school.
So I'm very interested about this professional poker angle because I have often thought that what we do for a living has an element of poker or gambling in it. And you mentioned there may be some sort of relationship between that and the work you do. Where do you see the parallels there?
I cannot think of any other sport or activity which is more parallel to trial lawyering than poker. You go to play Texas Hold'em, you know, you start off with a hand, and those are the facts of the case. And I tell clients this before every time we go into a mediation or settlement. I tell them, look, here's what I think we have. And sometimes if I have a great case, I'll tell them, I think we have pocket aces. But let me tell you the story of what happened when I went to the Horseshoe Casino. And it's a real story. I went all in with pocket aces pre-flop. If you don't know anything about poker, that means before any of the cards come down that everyone can use in the middle, you have the best hand and you're in the best situation and you're sitting on green pastures. I go all in and a lady, two seats to my right, calls me with pocket queens. I will not forget it. She flips over the pocket queens and I'm ecstatic. I think it's like 350 some bucks. It's not a world of cash. It's a 1-2 no limit game. And I'm thinking this is gravy, but I lose because one of the five cards that comes out is a queen. And so she has three of a kind and I only have two aces. Three of a kind beats two aces. I lost all my money. So I tell the clients, I said, look, you may not know this, but pocket aces still have around a 9% chance of losing pre-flop to another hand. And so even though we have the best hand, we go to trial. We don't know what those five cards, what those six jurors in Maryland are going to be. And we're going to be rolling the dice some. So you have to be able to accept that roughly 10% chance of loss, assuming we really do have pocket aces. And if you're not comfortable with that, we have to start taking some discounts to find your comfortable middle ground. That's the reality of it, where you could have the best hand, you could do everything perfect, everything right, and you could still lose. But what I tell clients, because I love going to trial and I want to try every case, maybe at some point when I get more tired and older, that'll change, but I want to try every case. And I tell clients, I want to try every case, but for me, it's easier to say that because when I lost that hand with pocket aces, I just reach into my pocket and buy in for another 500 and I play again. And statistically, in the long run, you'll be a winning lawyer. You'll be a winning poker player if you're doing all the right things. But I tell the clients, they can't reach into their pocket because they're just that one hand. And that one hand is one of 100 hands I'll play. So while it's good for the law of averages for me, they have to give some consideration as to whether they want to be the potential downturn on that averages and numbers game.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I would think that's a very effective way of explaining to clients what the risks and rewards are. Do people respond well to that explanation?
I always share that story at the Horseshoe, and it always brings the clients back to planet Earth because I had a call with a lawyer this morning where we were talking about these concepts of there is always, it seems in my experience, the clients on the plaintiff side have this extra level of layering because there's this natural distrust of lawyers. So their real number may be X, but they're telling us it's Y, and they're baking in some hedging because they don't trust us. And what I have found is when I tell the clients, I'll try the case because I love to go to court and it's fun for me and it's not going to be stress for me or work. It's part of what I love. And I'm happy to roll the dice for them. And I'm not going to take any discounts if they don't want to. It quickly disarms them because they realize, I can't be bluffing with Reza. I got to tell him the real number so we can figure out what it is because he's really going to pull the trigger if I try and play chicken with the other lawyer and use Reza as sort of the middle ground, as sort of the conduit to do that. So when I give them that story, it very quickly and I think very consistently gets the client to reveal what they really want, where they really are in terms of numbers, and then we can appropriately hedge and pin our valuations to try and get them to where they need to be.
I mean, I'm going to confess, I've never been particularly great at poker. When I go to a casino, I tend to play blackjack because I think it's a simpler game. And I think I know enough to be dangerous or at least lose less money at the blackjack table. But my impression of poker players is that to be very successful at that, you have to remove the emotion from decision-making and try to make cold and calculated decisions based on risk and really math. Do you think that's right? And when I think of it that way, and you think about the kind of cases we do and how much emotion plays into that, and both on the client side and then even with lawyers, because you can become emotionally attached to a case, both positive or negative probably. And then there's the added emotions of that come with the worry or concern about the risk, right? So is it better in your view if you're more of a poker player as a lawyer, or is there a place where it's the parallel no longer applies because we're in an inherently emotional and human business where you just can't be cold and calculating on the risk level at all times? How do you think about that?
I have, through natural process of my prior professional experiences, both the poker and doing professional sales, business-to-business sales, advertising, where it was always about the numbers, I seem to be very cold to the analysis, and I just seem to look at it as a numbers situation. I definitely get worked up about cases. I get emotional. I get fired up. I get angry. But at the end of the day, I'm very mathematical about the decision process that I'm making. Positive of that is there's always an anxiety when you go to trial, right? I don't know if that ever goes away. There's sort of like this anxiousness. You don't know what's going to happen. But in terms of the worry of going to trial, I find that I've never had that worry because I always think of it as, even if I have the best case, I go in just simply acknowledging that I could lose because I've lost $3,000 hands with, you know, pocket kings. And I know that, hey, that's just part of the game. And if you're not willing to go all in and lose that hand, then you shouldn't even be trying the case. The saying in poker is scared money is dead money. Scared money is dead money. So if you're a trial lawyer and you're scared of trying the case because of losing, I have concerns about whether that's going to impact the way you present the case or whether you're really being genuine about the valuation, because some of the fear is baking into that. And I think it shouldn't. In poker, the concept is called game theory optimal. GTO poker is where you're playing purely on mathematical decision-making, the appropriate calculated decision based on the risk and the probabilities of what the other person has based on certain formulas. I think trial can be done based on game theory optimal primarily. There are particular poker players, right? Like Patrick Antonis, if anyone knows about poker, that he's just great at reading people. So he's great at reading the room and making adjustments based on that. So the human element has to play into it once you're in the courtroom. But in terms of the decision of whether you should suit up or whether you really should be taking more discounts to settle, I think that should be a mostly, if not completely, mathematical decision. That's how I've treated it. And at least for me, it's ended up working in my benefit because I draw mathematical lines for opposing counsel. And I say, look, this is what I think the valuation is. And if you make me try the case, like, I'm okay with that. And like any person who's tried enough cases, I've gotten defensed a good number of times. I've gotten my zeros or I've gotten my check boxes on liability with zero damages. And you have to accept that these things can happen as part of the natural process of, we call it the game of trial work, like the game of lawyer. We're going to lose some hands, not even the best players, right? Not even Doyle Brunson won every tournament and won every hand. So once you accept that, I think it emboldens you to just continue to make the correct mathematical decision, despite the fact that you just lost the last two cases. Don't let that scare you into not trying a next one.
So let's move from poker to your trial practice. So one thing I've read about you is that you're a real student of the craft. We were talking before we went online about your watching trials on CVN and always trying to work to learn and perfect and get better. Can you give us sort of maybe in the last, I don't know, 5 years or so, what are the kind of the big things you think you've learned from reading, watching, practicing that have enhanced your skills as a trial lawyer?
The main thing that comes to mind, which has become a central tool that I use to frame and try cases, there was I think it's the date of my birth, so I know it's 1983, if I recall correctly, where Jerry Spence tried that famous McDonald's case, if you know what I'm talking about, the case where he framed it as a broken promise and the value of a handshake. And I got my hands on the transcript of the opening of that case. And what was really interesting, what Jerry Spence did in that opening, was he baked in some of the discovery issues and talked about how he got evidence compelled by orders of the court from the defendant. And I thought, wow, that's really creative. And it sort of lays the groundwork for some insinuation and sets some of the emotional stage for the games that the defense played. And then it wasn't long after that that I saw Raul's partner, Ryan Panish. I'm not going to remember the case name, but there's a $15-ish million verdict he got in a bus incident case. And I don't think it was a collision. A bus went over a speed bump or something of that nature, and a lady had a compression fracture. And I watched his opening on CourtView Network of that. And he did some excellent work in what I have framed, or what I label as landmines, and sort of setting up emotional staging. And he played the video from that opening, which showed the bus driver basically accusing the lady of faking it and you better not be playing, yada, yada, yada. And the imaging shows she had this terrible fracture. Those two things came together for me and created this sort of concept of what I call landmines. And it's become a central part of how I try my cases. And what I've done with that, as I do with everything, is, as I call it, I sprinkle crack on it. I take it to its absolute extreme. And I see how far it can run. And this concept of landmines has run very far for me, that I'll give credit to Panish and Jerry Spence for the initial breadcrumbs that got me there. And what I'm talking about is laying certain evidentiary traps for the defense, certain things that will get the jury to a place emotionally, almost the I can't get over it type issues, but backhandedly in a way that it just can't be overcome by the defense. So, you know, in the Brian Panish case I'm thinking of, it was that video and the bus driver's inflammatory accusations against the lady who had a broken spine, that she might be faking it. I watched it myself and I was getting angry, and I couldn't shake that anger as I watched the rest of the trial, and it impacted my view and the lens with which I looked at the remainder of the evidence. So to give you an example, I don't do much auto tort work anymore, but a classic example is they want to do a defense medical examination, and in Maryland, you're not going to win in getting those recorded. But what I will typically do is I will send a letter correspondence both to the DME doctor and to the defense lawyer saying, I want to video record it. I know they're going to say no, and I'll cave to that. But what happens is I have that letter and I give it to my client in a trial. If there's any dispute, as there usually is, about some fabrication that the DME doctor is coming up with about what happened or what was done at that exam, and that's being crossed on the plaintiff will have those letters and emails and say, well, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Defense Counsel, we asked that we could have this recorded so we wouldn't have to deal with this and you wouldn't let us record the exam. And suddenly the jury is like, oh, well, what's the defense up to? What are they hiding? Now, I don't trust the DME doctor's representation about this conflict. Why wouldn't you let them record it? What are you scared of? So you got to do a lot of creative thinking to sort of brainstorm these landmines. But I like to set a lot of these little landmines. And another one that just comes to mind because it's a case that I just resolved was a case where the defense records for a nursing home were about 3,500 pages, but they produced about 18 to 20,000 pages over the course of 9 different productions. They just kept reproducing 2, 3,000 pages with maybe 5 to 50 new pages snuck in that pack. As a result, our expert had $30,000 in billings. And I knew they're going to cross him on that. And he was prepared. It was a landmine because if they crossed him on all his high billings, he was going to say, well, counsel, you guys made this happen because you guys were hiding the records. And we had to keep coming back and asking you show us the full records. And you wouldn't give us everything. And we ended up having to come back to you 9 times. And what I want to know is why did you give your experts the real stack of 3,500, but you gave us 20,000 pages? Why wouldn't you let us see the whole truth and made us fish for the actual evidence? So little stuff like that I have found create such an emotional outrage that the focus groups I've done have shown me that if you can find creative and appropriate evidentiary ways of getting these things in front of the jury, that it creates such a taint that exposes the defense for the games they're playing, that it makes the credibility battle very lopsided in our favor, which gives us that small mathematical edge that we deserve for not playing those games or for being straight shooters. Again, you got to be a straight shooter and not play those games. If you have unclean hands, these things don't work for you. But if you're following the rules and you're doing the right things, this concept of landmining, my goal is, I tell folks, I like to get a half a dozen landmines if I can in my opening, lay the booby traps for them and some of the inflammatory aspects into the opening. And the case should usually be done at the opening if done correctly and make it very difficult for the defense to come back from it. That's the main thing. If I'm going to think of what have I really drawn from this, now, I can give lists of stuff because I've watched the entire Mark Lanier talcum powder trial on Courtview Network. I've watched a lot of Mitnick stuff. I read a lot of this material, but this concept of really stepping into the emotional component of what the jurors' decision-making is going to be for the global picture of how the case was handled, I think has found a lot of legs.
That's really, really smart. And I love the way you frame that. When I learned about landmines initially in my practice and working through a case earlier on with Philip Miller, who has an earlier episode on the podcast, who's great, by the way, but the concept of landmines was always how do you deal with landmines that are set by the defense and anticipating them and preemptively overcoming or eliminating them or turning them against the defense. But the idea of creating your own landmines is really smart. And I can see why that would be so effective. And the other part of it is that as a plaintiff's lawyer, I feel like we really are held to a high standard. And I think most of us meet those standards by honestly complying with discovery, meeting deadlines, doing all of the nuts and bolts required to be professional and responsible in handling the case in that fashion. But we so often encounter defense lawyers who don't play by that same rule book. But then when they get to the courtroom, they want to sterilize it as if the case just started the day that they picked the jury. And all of the stuff they've done to make your life a living hell and miserable and treat your client poorly and be unethical and dishonest and delay, all of that is no longer fair game, right? Because came beforehand and now they want to put a good face on it. Maybe they even change the lawyer for trial or it's the same lawyer, but it's not somebody you recognize because all of a sudden they're being kind and respectful, which they haven't been for the last 2 to 4 years. So finding a way to actually tell the real story of what's going on here through that kind of a landmine approach, I think is really, really brilliant. And to me, that's worth the price of admission for this podcast already. And we're only 20 minutes in. So that's really good stuff.
It's taken me a number of losses and test driving to get to that because I initially was putting way too much of the discovery and discovery history into my trial work. And I realized that I'm muddying up the situation. It took a lot for me to start to figure out which ones are the right issues. And the best advice I can give to anyone is take that group of stuff that you think are the issues and focus group the whole lot of them. And folks will tell you which ones they care about and which ones they don't. Like, I could think of a case where there were sort of insinuations about the credibility of me as the lawyer, and I put way too much focus on that. And I realized that the jury really didn't care about that. They thought, well, I'm not making the case about me by trying to rebut those credibility issues. And so I was in the wrong space. And so I started to try to figure out through losses and trial and error which ones are right issues. There's some template ones like the DME recording that I shared, which is going to work as a template for almost any auto case, depending on your state's laws. But every case will also have some unique ones, and you really got to dig and work hard and find creative ways to get those in.
Yeah, I imagine it's a very tricky balancing act, both with the judge and with the jury, because you don't want to seem petty and you don't want to, like you said, make it about you, compelling fact of your case on a substantive level. But probably, I mean, it's something that would be, that would reinforce a view that the jury is probably open to having, that somebody's being unfair, or they're being hypocritical, something like that, right? Some kind of core human theme that's truthful for the facts of your case and connects with the rest of the narrative that you're trying to.
And defense makes it easy for us, because one of the things I've started to realize is, I say with my partner here, the managing partner, Justin Brown, he said it and I say it, if we became defense lawyers, we would be unstoppable. We would crush every case because we would just convince the carriers to let us be honest. And if the defense was honest, if they picked what, if they've actually tried to figure out what the truth was, and they sold that truth as an alternate option for the jury to select, they would be so much better off. But the problem the defense has, and I don't think we need David Ball to even tell us this, it should be so well known, the reality of how we live our lives is a certain way. There's the general reality of how interactions and decision-making is made outside of court. It's different than the decision-making in court. So we've all walked into court at some point, and the defense lawyer says, we don't have any burden in this case, or something to that effect. The plaintiff has to prove blah, blah, blah. And the defense doesn't get it. It doesn't work like that in normal life. The defense can't come in and say it wasn't our dog, but if it was our dog, he didn't bite him. But if he did bite him, he didn't bite him that hard. And if he did bite him that hard, he wasn't that hurt. The defense is thinking, well, these are the elements, these are the laws, I can make alternate arguments. But in normal worldview, jurors hear that and they think, well, wait a minute. That can't be right. You're basically hedging, which means you're not being truthful. You haven't actually figured out what happened. And so the defense makes it easy for us because they're doing this legal approach, which works perfectly through discovery and through motions practice. But when you get into a courtroom, you can't do that because that's not the way things work in real life. So it makes it easy for us. It gives us easy ammunition to polarize and to show, look, they're not being honest with you because they're picking seven options with fallback options. They can't believe in their story that it wasn't their dog, because why are they making all these arguments? Well, if it was my dog, you wouldn't have to argue about it. If it was your dog, you didn't bite that hard, because you're saying it's not your dog. It's the end of the story. And so that costs some credibility. And that's some stuff I picked up from trial by human materials. If I recall correctly, Raleigh has some of that stuff where he talks about some, what I call polarization techniques, where, you know, you cross the defense and the experts on their theories and how those theories didn't exist from before the lawsuit. Makes it very easy. Well, you're saying it happened because of this. That's not in the medical records. When'd you come up with that idea, Mr. Doctor? And so there's these ample opportunities where when you start to look at the case as, how is this play if I'm just telling grandma at the kitchen table the story, and I got to tell it like that to the jury? And if I can't tell like that to the jury, there's going to usually be a problem. Maybe that's a case that you should settle because the story don't add up.
That's so right.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show, that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com.
So let's talk about some of the cases that you've worked on. I know you recently got a $9 million verdict in a nursing home case, and you do a lot of nursing home cases. And I'm interested in that. We actually have not had anybody on the podcast, quite miraculously, for 3 years now, who specializes in handling nursing home cases. So I think for those out there that may do these types of cases or see one occasionally, it'll be interesting to talk a little bit about how you put those together and your approach and what it takes to have a so-called nursing home case. And by way of background, I cut my teeth and before I became sort of focused on non-nursing home medical malpractice cases, which is mostly what I do, I spent, I don't know, the better part of at least 5 or 10 years doing a lot of nursing home cases. So at one point knew how to do those cases and I thought was reasonably good at them, but it's been a little bit of time since I've done that. So can you kind of give us the background and primer for the uninitiated on what is a nursing home case and how do you do those cases?
Sure. So I've been doing nursing home cases pretty much exclusively for about 3 years now. I was doing mass torts. I switched from mass torts and started doing lead paint, went from lead paint and started to do mostly auto trucking with some mixed bag premises. And then from that, I switched over to nursing home, which I've been doing for, again, like I said, about 3 years now. Nursing home cases are really cool in that you don't have the same type of fight, ambiguous fight about the standards of care that you would in a normal med mal. Because nursing home cases, in my view, and I think a lot of other nursing home lawyers would agree, are very parallel to trucking cases, which, you know, you look at the FMCSA and you have this body of regulations which helps give the roadmap of the breaches and the duties. Well, there are nursing home regulations that do that for nursing homes in the very same way. It talks about when a care plan has to be done, when it has to be redone, when assessments are done, documentation standards, the definition of when a pressure ulcer or bed sore should or should not happen. So you start with the regulations as your understanding. I would think it's fair to say that a lot of lawyers probably don't do dibble-dabbling in nursing home because to do them really well, you really got to dig into these regulations. And I could see the ROI not being very worth it if you're doing them as one or two offs because we're talking about very juicy sets of regulations and to get into them, it doesn't really make sense to do it for a few cases. But once you get a feel for those, the duty and the breach fights are a lot of fun because you're not fighting about this literature over that literature like you would in a hospital bed sore case. It's really one core regulation which you can use to establish duty and breach. And then from there, the way that I frame my nursing home cases, I say this subjectively because I'm not going to say this is the approach. This is just how I do it. I frame my nursing home cases by sifting through the whole set of records and file and looking for what I call red flags and landmines. That's really it. I know a lot of folks will look at it and say, well, let me look at the causation issues. Let me look at the damages issues. I take a different approach. I'm looking for cases to try. I want to try cases. And I'm therefore looking for cases with these red flags and landmines, which I will group together and simply call intangibles. And the more intangible—
Can you give us some examples?
Sure. An example of an intangible. An example of an intangible would be someone comes into the nursing home and they should get a certain assessment done and it should get done in the first week within 7 days of admission by regulation. And it's not done for a month, but it's backdated for that first week. That's a huge intangible. It's sort of an inflammatory factor. Someone develops a bed sore or they have a fall and the care plan is not done and then something else happens. I like to use 3 as my magic number, 3 red flags, notice issues, and the care plan is never redone. Well, that's another intangible. So I'm sifting for all these miscellaneous intangibles, blank spaces for when certain charting should be done. I consider that an intangible. Folks documenting that they did a bunch of things at the same time that just possibly couldn't have happened. Like I've seen where someone apparently toileted someone, gave them a bath, helped them with mobility, and did their personal hygiene, hair, clipping nails, all within 5 minutes based on the documentation. They're going to argue, obviously, no, I did this all and I lump charted. Well, you can't really do that. So that's an intangible. It creates a friction point for the defense. So I'm going through and I'm tallying up these intangibles. And if there's enough intangibles where I get a vibe that I could really destroy the credibility of the facility and cast doubt on everything they did, that's a case that I want to take. And the reason I want to take it is because what I have found, and I figured this out when I was doing my auto practice, and I developed a whole system at the firm I was at of intangibles. We were using FileVine, and I created a system where on intake, every intake person in paralegal had to sift the case and the file for sort of Rez's checklist of intangibles. And we created a field in FileVine where they would check the boxes. And anytime five boxes or more got checked, it would send a notice to me, hey, Reza, this case has five or more intangibles. Come look at it. And the reason five became the magic number, because in my auto cases, at one point, I went back and I looked at all the cases that I had done for whatever it was, 2-3 years. I looked at all the cases and I found that every case that had significantly higher settlement or verdict than what we reasonably expected, they all had a common denominator. They all had five or more intangible factors.
That's a fascinating list that I'm sure folks would love to have access to. Can you give us a summary of what was on that list? Or
it's going off memory because I haven't done it in a few years and it's with my prior firm. Things like, did the defendant have a really nice car? Were they driving a Lincoln Navigator? Were they driving a new Mercedes S-Class? It's just one of those things. A jury, you know, it's going to impact the jury. Injury photos, good injury photos. Did the plaintiff do a lot of volunteer work? Was an intangible factor, I remember. So if someone was going to the church or helping clean up the neighborhood, things like that, that was an intangible factor. I will give credit to Keith Mitnick for this, but if the property damage had structural components of the vehicle replaced, especially the rear beam or front beam, that was an intangible factor. And Keith Mitnick talks about that with respect to a case that had very low visible property damage, but the rear beam was replaced, not just repaired. And as I remember him framing it, can you imagine how hard that impact must have been to crush a metal beam in the back of the car that they had to replace? So if I had that structural damage, that was an intangible factor. Positive imaging, it's an obvious one. Intangible factor. If more come to me, I'll let you know. But I remember
that's a good list, though. I could see why that tracks exactly with what my experience on in those types of cases. So yes, that's great.
Five seemed to be the magic number, and I use a similar, I haven't formalized it for nursing home the way I did for auto cases because it's not the same volume. So I'm just putting eyes on each case myself, but I'm really sifting for intangible factors. The thing I like about the intangible factors are they don't bake into the defense and the carrier's formulation for valuation of a case. So when I say to the defense, I want $100,000 for this missed case, like the soft tissue connective tissue case, and it's because the defendant was driving an S-Class and the DME doctor wouldn't let me record and all these other intangibles. I know that these things are going to get a jury to give me $100,000 or more, but the defense and their Colossus algorithm was telling them, no, this is soft tissue, 3 months, PT, chiro, this case is only worth 25. What are you talking about? And so the intangible factors are great because they create trial opportunities. And if you love trying cases, it's going to give you cases that you're going to get to try. You're going to get to try them and likely do well because you have a lot of good inflammatory factors. And the defense, by the time they wake up to it, it's going to be too late. They're not going to realize what's happening. Now, I've settled cases and during trial, once defense realized and woke up, like, oh, I see how the jury's reacting to these intangibles. I underestimated the impact. And that's fine. If it settles then it settles then. You got your result. But I look at all my nursing home cases on the intangible factors. And I'm sure we'll talk about the $9 million verdict I got recently. And that case was heavily framed on intangible factors. I know I did a presentation for the Maryland Association for Justice, which is the Maryland version of AAJ. And a lot of nursing home lawyers were asking me, well, how did you deal with this issue? And these were like medical causation issues. And I remember thinking to myself, well, I didn't make those an issue. Why am I worried about that? I'm worried about the stuff that's going to get the jury angry. I want them to fight on my field, which are, why did you write down you did this thing that you didn't do? And why did you backdate this assessment? And I just kept dropping these landmines and kept throwing intangible factors. It's just grenade after grenade after grenade. It got to a point where the defense just has to constantly play defense and they never get to move the ball forward. They're stuck in their own side of the field and they can't recover.
Yeah, and I do want to get into the details of that case, but your overall approach to nursing home cases is so smart. And I think it lawyers that do primarily non-nursing home medical malpractice in some ways can be the worst lawyers to handle a nursing home case because you just can't look at a nursing home case through the same lens as you do a traditional malpractice case in certain ways, I think. Our intake standards for nursing home cases, which I think tracks similarly to what you're saying, is that we'll take a case about abuse or neglect, but we don't want to malpractice in a nursing home because it's not, did you miss something on one occasion? Did somebody make a mistake? It's, can you show a pattern of behavior that raises a bigger question of, is there more of a systemic neglect going on here? And the reality is, to get a large verdict, you need to have more than just an incident that resulted in an injury, because most of the time folks in nursing homes have, like you said, a number of many medical problems, which is why they're in a nursing home to begin with. But once you acknowledge that, the defense of, well, this person had medical problems, well, but your whole business is premised on people with medical problems needing to be in custodial settings to be cared for. So if you don't want those people there, you know, like, why don't you get out of that business? So no, it really resonates what you're saying about that. What you're talking about in terms of the red flags really amounts to just pure fraud in many cases, right? They're charting things they didn't do. They're representing things that they aren't doing. They're violating their obligations to provide care that they promised to provide, that they're getting paid for. Right. So it's a broken and fraudulent business model that's enriching people at the expense of the elderly that need that care. Can you tell us the facts of the case that you tried to the $9 million verdict? And then maybe we can talk about how you framed it and how you presented the case to the jury.
In a nutshell, without getting lost in the weeds, early 60s, a male has a stroke, goes into a nursing home for short-term rehab post-stroke. With a world of health issues, it is a substantial hemorrhagic stroke. So we know statistically his likelihood of a good recovery is slim. He never fully rebounds, but within 1 week, he starts to develop a bed sore on what I just call mid-body area above his buttocks. Within 3 weeks, it becomes a stage 3 pressure ulcer. Upon discharge from the nursing home, within about a week, it becomes stage 4, and that's the worst stage. It's 1, 2, 3, and 4 for bed sores, stage 4 bed sore. Within about 5 months thereafter, he never returns to the nursing home. Within about 5 months thereafter, he facility hops to a number of places, including at home, where arguably the wife mismanages handling his wound care and a wound vac that was treating the wound, which the record suggests led to an infection of the wound, which eventually led to his death. So in short, we have a gentleman post-stroke in a nursing home for a total of about 1 month, discharged, dies about 5 months later from an infection that happened while he was at home receiving care from his wife.
That is a very, very hard case.
I will tell you that a number of people told me that it's a very difficult case. I think mostly through naivety, didn't see the difficulties in the case, simply because I was looking at it through one lens, which is I saw a bunch of red flags. I saw a bunch of good intangibles. And as I pieced it together, I focus grouped it a few times. I saw a story that was really clean and consistent. And as we all know, the cleaner the story is, the less you have to go on these sort of side rails to explain things, the stronger your case will be. And I just thought the story was so good. That's all I saw. I got tunnel vision on this really, really clean, simple story with a lot of landmines. And I thought, I'm going to go into trial. I'm going to just keep throwing grenades. And the defense is hopefully never going to be able to rebound. And that's exactly what happened. So the case.
So tell us the story then.
The story that I saw was a few fold. And the entire case, I will say, was framed around a few concepts. One of them, I like to give credit where it's due. One of them, I borrowed from Keith Mitnick. I think he got a $12 million nursing home bed sore verdict. And he does these things called brushstrokes. And I use that to undermine a lot of the defenses. So this was not a do-it-yourself job. It's not a DIY job. They had to turn and reposition him. If they didn't do it, it wasn't going to get done. That was one theme. Another theme was you can't judge a book by its cover. I don't know how and where I came up with this one, but it became really important because you may recall from my summary of facts, the guy is discharged with a stage 3 pressure ulcer. Most nursing home lawyers would say, Reza, you're out of your mind. You're basically trying a stage 3 case against a nursing home. The way I saw it was it became stage 4 within a week of his discharge to the hospital. I didn't sue the hospital. I didn't blame the hospital. But my argument was, you can't judge a book by its cover. This thing might have been stage 4 the whole time, and we just don't know because they didn't do the surgery where they removed the dead tissue. It's called the debridement. That wasn't done until later. And after the debridement's done, you see that it's a stage 4. So I really pounded that theme throughout the whole case, and I think it worked in allowing the jury to conclude that this really was a stage 4 wound at the nursing home. So it reached its full worseness in the care of the defendant. And then the other theme was an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. The whole case largely became about that issue. It was a huge part of my opening, a major part of my closing, sprinkled it throughout cross. And the whole thing was if this wound didn't develop, none of the health issues he had were an issue. And there is I'm going to forget his name, Michael Lieberman, I believe, the Zen lawyer, has this thing he calls the five cores. And one of his five cores is this concept of, if not this, but for that, the sort of reality. And he talks about it in the context of a case where if the defendant doesn't run the stop sign, it doesn't matter how fast the plaintiff was going on an issue of contrib or not. And so I use that here. I said, look, it doesn't matter that he got COVID, which he did. My guy got COVID after he had the wound. So it doesn't matter if he got COVID. Doesn't matter if he had circulatory issues. Doesn't matter that he had diabetes. Doesn't matter that the infection happened in the wife's care, because the wife wouldn't mismanage a wound if the wound didn't exist. COVID couldn't make the wound healing more difficult if there was no wound to make more difficult to heal. So the whole case became about who sparked the fire. And whoever sparked the fire is responsible for the snowball effect. And that became central. It all became about who done it. And I continuously pulled to that. And appreciating the vulnerabilities in the case as I got closer to the trial, I started to see more of these issues. I made a slight switch in the way I normally frame things. I think it's David Ball that says the case is what you make it about in terms of how much time you spend on the case, right? Which is basically don't forget about damages, as he talks about in Damages 3. Well, I generally will do something closer to 50-50. In this case, I did something like 80-20 or 90-10. I'm talking 80 to 90% liability and only 10-20% damages. I continuously pounded the drum of what a villain the nursing home is, continuously talked about the false charting, the untimely charting, the lump charting, the backdating of records. I just kept throwing these grenades on there, and the defense was constantly on their heels. And when I spoke with the jury afterwards, they don't think the nursing home was doing the things that they said they did, and they don't even think the defense experts read the records. They don't think the care was provided. And so that's what it really boiled down to. The jury was so angry about the liability that they gave a number for damages. Now, mind you, the damages, while I only did 10 to 20% damages, there was some good stuff there, really gruesome photos, right? The guy died, a helpful death certificate and autopsy report, 3 grieving children and a grieving wife. The guy was a pastor. So I had some good intangibles and some damages stuff to put on, but I really minimized the time I spent on it. And I decided that I'm going to try the lie, so to speak. I'm going to let the liability story get the jury to where they need to be, and then they'll do the damages justice.
Well, that's really just an incredible result for that case. I think that's a case that 9 out of 10 lawyers would have turned away when hearing the basic facts of somebody who left a nursing home with a documented stage 3 pressure ulcer and then went 5 months, including in and out of other care facilities, a hospital, and at home with wound care, including wound vac and infection that came on after leaving the nursing home. So that really is an incredible result. But the way you narrowed the framing and focus of that, I can see why that would have been effective. And there's a core truth to what you're saying about the, you know, if you don't allow the problem to occur to begin with, then all of the other things that flowed out of that would not have happened. I mean, that seems self-evident. But going back to that first argument, you still have to establish that they neglected his care and allowed and didn't follow the regulations, didn't turn and reposition him, weren't attentive to the wound in a way that allowed it to develop and where it could have been prevented had they done other things, right? And especially for somebody just coming off of a stroke and is probably has very little independent mobility, that can be a difficult situation to manage. So how did you handle that part of the case to gain so much traction on that, on the negligence piece, which was also, I'm sure, quite difficult part of the case?
Yeah, that's the big issue in these bed sore cases. It's always, at least in my experience, the nursing home says they turned and repositioned the person and they just didn't write it down, or they didn't have to write it down because it's such a natural part of what they do that they don't need to write it down. It's just the natural nursing 101. And we take the position that no, you have to write it down. And the cross-exam, now they can argue that for motions practice, but the cross-exam makes that really easy. And I do think on that issue, we won the case on cross-examination because it's easy to expose the disingenuousness of that. So the defense nurses say, we always turned and repositioned him because we needed to. All right, well, how'd you keep track of when you did it every 2 hours? Oh, we just knew. Well, how'd you know when the last time you did it for? You got 10 residents, right, you're caring for. Each of them are going to need 10 to 20 tasks each, let's say 150 tasks. Are you memorizing 150 tasks over the course of an eight-hour shift? It's just so easy to expose it on cross. And if they really say they memorized it, they say, okay, well, don't you agree that you have to turn and reposition someone also as needed? It's not a robotic 12, 2, 4, 6, 8. What if they have an incontinence episode? Would you turn and reposition them then? Yes, I do. Okay, well, boom, there goes your 12, 2, 4, 6 schedule. Now you turn someone at 3 o'clock. How are you going to keep track that the next one is at 5 o'clock? How do you adjust your schedule? They don't have an answer for it. And then how do you keep track of what position you turn people in? How do you know what position that the next shift should turn someone in, right? I mean, during the cross-examination of the defense expert, wound expert, I took off my blazer and I lay down on the floor in the middle of the well. And I said, all right, imagine that I'm Mr. Mack. Now, nurse Betsy Sue wants to be diligent. So she turns me off my backside, or she turns me from my left side onto my backside, and she leaves for her shift. Now nurse Johnson comes in on the next shift, and she's going to turn me again onto the same side because she wants to be ultra diligent. I'm now on the same side I was just on for 2 hours because she thinks she's being diligent. How are you going to prevent that from happening if you don't write it down? The truth is they can't keep track of it if they don't write it down. And I turned down the majority of nursing home cases I review because they are writing it down. They are charting every 2 hours, turning and repositioning, so we know it's done, when it's done, how it's done. And it's easy because if you go look at the hospital record, which I do in every case, go look at the hospital records for your cases, your bed sore cases, and you will see that the hospitals are religiously documenting turning and repositioning in the flow sheets and the position. And I use that to polarize it as well. Well, you say that you don't need to write it down. How come the hospital that you send into for COVID was documenting it every 2 hours? Uh-oh. It's just the common sense cross on it shows that it's not credible that they say they did it. And it turns into a huge credibility issue of the nursing home just saying, just trust us, we did it.
And then, well, especially since he obviously developed that wound during the time they're claiming that they did it. But did they acknowledge in that case that the wound was caused by unrelieved pressure? Did they come up with some other theory for the wound, which I've seen many times, such as a deep tissue injury or some prior thing that only declared itself later? Or did they have some alternative hypothesis, or did they agree this was a pressure injury?
They didn't agree, which is crazy, despite the fact that all their own records called it a pressure injury. They did what I've seen every nursing home defense lawyer do, which is they try to relabel it as a diabetic wound or a vascular wound or an arterial wound. They try and call it anything else. They say his underlying health issues caused this wound. Now, the problem they have with that, Nick Rowley gives us the tool, which is they didn't say that back in 2020 when this was happening. This is something that the lawyers and the experts they hired came up with after the lawsuit was filed. And so that just easily exposes the fact that if this really was a vascular wound, which has a different etiology, different presentation, different coloration, then they would have called it that. And so that's how we address that issue. It had to be a pressure wound because that's what they truthfully wrote down and said at the time. The only people that are not calling it pressure are the lawyers after the lawsuit was filed.
Well, that's really a terrific result in that case, and congratulations. You applied many different effective strategies and principles to get to that point. that have broader application, but that really is a terrific, terrific result.
One of the difficult parts of that case, I will say, was we had $500,000 offer on the table during trial. It got to a point where the judge even pulled us in chambers, had me and my client sit in her courtroom while she stepped out and said, I'm going to give you all a chance to speak privately to really think about this. Maryland has a $1 million-ish cap. So best case scenario, we were only going to recover about $1 million, and we got $500 on the table. It was a really tough position for the client. And the way I framed it for the client, I thought, look, I just got to be honest with her. And I said, here's the reality. Of that $500,000, attorney's fees are getting paid off that. So if you accept that, that's $200,000 coming my way. I believe in your case enough where I'm willing to say no to the $500,000 and roll the dice with that $200,000 of my money. That's how much confidence I have in this. That's real money I'll put on the table. If you want to do it, let's do it. If not, let's settle. And everyone walks away and I have no complaints. And that really gave her the wake-up call of how I feel about the case. It's like, oh, wow, I'm not just bluffing and playing poker. This is real money that I'm gambling with. And if I'm willing to do it, I must feel strongly about it. And she decided she's going to roll with the two, and then it paid off.
I meant to ask you, was the defendant in that case one of the large nursing home chains that we've heard about? And did that play into the case at all, do you think?
No, it wasn't the chain. It was the second largest nursing home in the state of Maryland, the largest nursing home, if I recall correctly, in that county, Baltimore County, and part of the Mercy Medical System, which is a multi-billion dollar hospital chain system. But it's not one of the usual suspects like Manor Care or Genesis in terms of nursing home.
Well, Reza, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your knowledge and that great result with us. I really, really appreciate it. And good luck with continued success. If folks want to talk to you about a nursing home case, or they have something in Maryland where they want to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to find you?
My email, reza at k, b as in boy, a, attorneys. So there'll be two A's there, KBA attorneys with an S.com. Or I hope I don't regret this, I'll share my cell phone, 301-922-4598. Don't worry, I put it on silent after 10 p.m. So just call me whenever you want and text me. I'm happy to always talk shop and chat with fellow lawyers.
Well, thanks so much.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.